The last 2 weeks, as we began the study of the Church's moral teaching, we had two chapters that dealt with life in Christ. And what those chapters did was lay out for us basic moral principles that the Church operates out of and that are then applied to specific moral issues. Today, we're going to begin with the Ten Commandments, and we're going to be looking at those first three commandments, which deal with our relationship with God. And what the Ten Commandments do is they allow us then to take those principles and to look at specific moral issues. It's amazing that here's this this list of commandments that were given over 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and which still serve as well today as they did 3,000 years ago as a formula for guiding us in our moral life. Even though life has changed in so many ways, technology has changed in so many ways, culture has changed in so many ways, really human nature has not changed that much, and the truth of God has not changed at all. So we're still dealing with the same basic essential realities. So what are the role of the commandments? Let's just talk first of all about the commandments before we get into talking about these first three. You know, last week as we talked about morality, one of the things I noted is that we human beings did not need divine revelation in order to know that certain things were right and certain things were wrong. That long before there was divine revelation, long before there was the Ten Commandments that were given to Moses and to the Hebrew people, the people already knew that it was wrong to kill, that it was wrong to steal, that it was wrong to commit adultery. We already had a sense of right and wrong. We already had a sense of that there are certain things we ought to do, and there are certain things we ought not to do. That is written in our beings as human beings. The church calls this the natural law. The natural law. That morality is not something separate from us. It is not something foreign to us. There was probably nobody in the Jewish community as Moses first proclaimed the Ten Commandments who went, "Wow, we didn't see that one coming." All right, if you look at them, we would all presume, okay, these are definitely, there's no surprises in the Ten Commandments. We as human beings already have a sense of that. What this does is it codifies that in a specific way. But we already had a sense of right and what is wrong. Now, that sense of right and wrong has been damaged by original sin. Again, with the original creation, before original sin got into the mix, that virus that has gotten into the spiritual hard drive of the human soul and has distorted things, it would have been much more clear to us what was right and what is wrong. And we would have had a natural disposition to always choose to do what is right and to avoid what is wrong. What happened through the fall is that our reason was clouded so that we do not always see as clearly as we ought what it is that we ought to do and what we ought not to do. We've not gone blind. It's not that we can't see at all, but we don't see as clearly as we ought. All right, that original sin has darkened to some extent our reason, our capacity to think and to recognize this. Also, the will has been damaged, not destroyed, but damaged by original sin, where we were created originally by God with a predisposition to good, to avoid evil. We now know that every one of us has a tendency within our souls towards sin, that there is that rebelliousness that is in us. And again, that is the virus that has gotten into the hard drive of the human soul. And so our intellect and our will are both damaged and distorted by original sin. Now, if you're familiar at all with the theology of John Calvin, who was one of the primary leaders of the Protestant Reformation, he said that the human soul was entirely corrupted by original sin. All right? That essentially any capacity for the soul to know and do good was destroyed. and that there is nothing good within the natural human soul any longer. That is not our Catholic position. Our Catholic position is that the human soul has been wounded by original sin, but that it has not been entirely corrupted by original sin. So again, what does that mean? It means that even before there was revelation, as clouded as our vision is, we can recognize that certain that things were right and wrong. Not always as good at that as we ought to be, and we also, there is still that part of us that wants to do what is right. There is that part of us that wants to do that what is good, even before we experience supernatural grace through baptism and through the other sacraments. Okay? So, but what the Ten Commandments do is they lay out for us how to be in right relationship, first of all with God, and secondly with others. They are a very simple codification of the natural law that God had given to us. And so this is what is referred to in the scripture as righteousness. What is righteousness? Righteousness is right relationship with God, first and foremost, and right relationship with others. And what does it mean to be in right relationship with God? Jesus makes this all very simple for us when he gives us the two great commandments, which summarize, the first one summarizes the first three of the commandments, and the second one summarizes the final seven. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. That's right relationship with God. When I love God with all my heart, with all my soul, with all my mind, then I am in relationship, right relationship with God. And he says, and the second is like unto it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. That summarizes, he says, the law and the prophets. Everything that is written in the law and the prophets is summarized in those two great commandments. And really, those are, become the headings for these two sections, what we might call the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. Often that's how it's portrayed, with three on the one tablet and seven on the other. And we could use the two great commandments as headings on each one of those tablets. All right? This is about right relationship with God. Now we're going to talk about today about those first three. Those first three, which define our relationship with God, which guide our relationship with God. I really think, too, this is that sometimes I think we've neglected to stress the importance of these, because obviously when we get into the others, that's where we get into kind of the sticky, muddy, messy moral issues, all right? And it's kind of where we want to move to right away. But the reality is, if I get the first three commandments right in my life, if I get those straight in my life, the last seven become a lot easier to live up to, all right? They just flow more naturally. When I'm in right relationship with God, it's a lot easier for me to be in right relationship with you. And when I'm not in right relationship with God, sometimes you are a little bit hard to deal with. All right? And probably when you're not in good relationship with God, I'm a little bit hard to deal with. So that's just the way it tends to be. When we're in right relationship with God, when we're okay there, somehow we tend to be pretty much okay in the other aspects of our lives. But when that's not working out, all right, that's where we tend to get lost in the other areas of our lives. So this is really important, as this guides us in terms of what it means for us to have a relationship with God. Again, we are covering three chapters tonight, chapters 25, 26, 27, and I ask you to read that. They're pretty short chapters, so it's not like I gave you a huge amount of reading material, and so we're just going to get into this. I'm the Lord your God. You shall not have other gods besides me. And that can be sometimes phrased, you may not have strange gods before me, or however. It all says the same thing. I am the Lord your God. You shall not have other gods besides me. Faithfulness to the one true God. Belief in the one true God. Serving the one true God. Now, when this commandment was given to Moses, it was not clear at that time. We tend to live in a culture where pretty much everybody around us, if they believe in God, believe in one God. All right? There's not a whole lot of full-blown pagans running around that we're dealing with on a regular basis who are worshiping multiple gods, who are worshiping Zeus and Hera and all of these others. There are some. I've run into some people who call themselves pagans and who do that. But the reality is you start talking to them and they don't really believe in these gods at all. They just like being odd and different and doing stuff that shocks everybody else is primarily what they are doing. And they kind of think of those gods as the various forces of nature that they are somehow connecting with. It's very, you know, all that very new agey kind of thing. Not too many of them actually believe that these gods are sitting up on Mount Olympus and doing all this kind of stuff. So most of the people that we are going to deal with. Now, if you get into a world where there are a lot of Hindus, if you're perhaps even there are people in our culture and our society who are Hindu, and you may find some who do believe in these multiple gods. But for the most part, we don't. But in the time of the Old Testament, the vast majority of the world was pagan, and they believed in many gods. And if I believed in many gods, all right, I had my gods that were part of my country or my territory or whatever, and I traveled to your country and you had other gods, and probably what I would do is not set, it would not be a big problem, all right, that, you know, you believe in these gods and I believe in these gods. We'd probably say, okay, well, I'll worship your gods too, and you worship my gods too, and we just kind of add to that. There was no sense that, you know, there was any obstacle there. Abraham seems to have been one of the very first people in all of human history who came to this to relationship with the one God. But even there, it's not clear that Abraham believed that there was only one God who existed. All right? He believes that this one God came to him and invited him to have a relationship with him and said, if you will obey me, then I will bless you, and I will watch over you. And so Abraham says, yes. But if you read through the stories of Abraham, it's not clear that he has arrived at what we might understand as monotheism, the idea that there is only one God, but that this God is my God. All right? There may be other gods, but this is mine. All right? This is the one God who for some reason has chosen me. It's really more when we get to Moses, hundreds of years later, that we begin to get more and more into a clearer sense that there is only one God. That there is not just that this is our God and everybody else has their gods, but there is only one God. And these other gods simply are not gods. They simply are not. Most of them don't exist at all. Scripture implies that there may be some demons that portray themselves as gods. But that most of the time people are just simply, they're worshiping forces of nature, right? And which they are somehow seeing as actually God. So Moses first experiences God on the mountain with the burning bush. When God comes to him and says, and speaks to him, and Moses, it tells him, Moses, I have chosen you. You are going to be my instrument who is going to go to Pharaoh and is going to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And Moses begins trying to squirm out of that. All right? He begins to try and talk his way out of this. This does not sound like a job he wants any part of. And eventually one of the questions that he asks God is, who are you? Who am I to tell the people I talk to? I'm just going to go and say this bush talked to me. All right? I saw this burning bush. Now who am I supposed to tell them you are? What is your name? What is your name? And God says to Moses, I am who am. Tell them that I am sent you. I am. All right. Now we will get later when we talk about the commandment to honor the Lord's name. All right. We'll go into that more deeply. But he begins to reveal himself to Moses, and then to reveal himself as the only God. In fact, he will set himself up. The great battles that go on in the plagues are really battles not so much between God and the Egyptians as between God and the gods of the Egyptians. All right, where he is defeating them. The first commandment, I am the Lord your God, you shall not have other gods besides me, calls us into right relationship with God. And we think of that in terms of those three theological virtues that we mentioned last week: faith, hope, and love. Faith in the one true God, hope in the one true God, loving the one true God. Let's talk about faith. Faith. What is faith? Faith is a response. God has said, God has revealed himself to us. He has said, this is who I am, and this is who you are. This is my plan for you. He has revealed himself to us as our creator. He has revealed himself to us as our father. He has said, this is my plan for you. This is my agenda for you, my goal for you. This is how I want you to live. Faith is our saying yes to God. It is our response to God. It's not simply believing in certain doctrines, all right? Faith is faith in a person, all right? It is my yes to a person, to God himself. I believe the various tenets of our faith because they have been revealed to us by the God who I believe and I trust and who I have said yes to. Now, as we heard on Sunday, faith without works is dead. So the faith that is our yes to God is more than just simply, oh, how about that? I guess so. You know? And again, there are many people who say that they believe in God. All right? There aren't that many people actually who say that they don't believe in God. It's only about 10%. We'll talk about atheism a little bit later. But it's a very small percentage. The vast majority of people say that they believe that there is a God. That's not faith. That's not faith. I mean, if you say, I believe that in the existence of Father Mike, that's not faith. If you say, you know what, I trust Father Mike, and I can count on him, that's faith. All right? Same thing with God. Saying I believe that God exists is not faith. Saying I trust God, I have confidence in him, that is faith. And especially the faith that has works, where it actually, I show that faith by the way in which I live. Now, the book talked about three sins against the virtue of faith, which would be three sins against the first commandment. The first is heresy. Heresy. What is heresy? Heresy is defined as an obstinate post-baptismal denial of some essential truth. Right? It is an obstinate post-baptismal denial of some essential truth. If I've been raised in a home and in a family where I've been taught that, and maybe even gone to schools or had training, what little training I may have in my faith, that I am a Catholic, but I believe that the Eucharist is symbolic, that it is a symbolic change of the bread and wine to the body and the blood of Christ, that there is not a real substantial change, but that spiritually, all right, we feel closer to Jesus as we celebrate that. And is that heresy? Is that heresy? No, that is not yet heresy, all right? It's wrong, all right? It's wrong, but it's not yet heresy. Heresy is an obstinate rejection, denial of some truth. So if I don't know any better, I'm not a heretic. I'm wrong, all right? Heresy is when somebody has sat down with me and said, okay, Mike, you're mistaken on this. Let's explain. This is what the church believes. This is what the church teaches. Here's why the church believes and teaches what it does, all right? And I say, well, I don't care. I don't believe it. Now I'm moving into heresy. Now, because it requires an obstinacy, all right? It requires, heresy is an obstinate denial of some essential truth. It is also an obstinate post-baptismal denial of some essential truth. If I have never been baptized, I cannot be a heretic. I can't. Only baptized Christians can be heretics. If I am a Jew and I say, absolutely, I reject the idea that Jesus is truly human, truly divine, that God has become human and has come into the world and has died on the cross and risen from the dead, am I a heretic? No, I'm wrong. But I'm not a heretic, all right? Heresy, all right? Heresy is an obstinate post-baptismal denial of some essential truth. Of some essential truth. Now, we have here in the greater Cincinnati area in the last few weeks been reading some articles that deal with heresy, with obstinate post-baptismal denial of essential truths. All right? How many of you have been reading about a sister in Cincinnati who has been forbidden to teach? All right? And why has she been forbidden to teach? Because she is teaching that there is no reason that women cannot be ordained priests by the Catholic Church. All right? That's her opinion, and she has been teaching that. But the Catholic Church has said, this is not just, we're not just doing this because this is how we kind of feel about it. All right? We just don't want women being priests, and that's why we're not going to do it. We cannot ordain women because by what authority can we change what Jesus has done and do something entirely different? Jesus could have chosen women to be priests, but for some reason, he did not choose to do that. For 2,000 years, the church has understood that Christ intended to ordain only men. And so the church has examined it. Is there any way we can get around this? Is there any way that theologically we can say that there is an opening here, that this teaching can be changed? And the church has said, we've looked at it, it's not there. The church cannot change this teaching because it certainly seems from all that we can see that this was the true intention of Jesus Christ, our founder. Now, by what authority can we change it? By what authority? How can we change it? Simply because it's not politically correct? Because it's not the way our society understands it? No. And so, now, is this woman allowed to have her own opinion? As an American citizen, she's allowed to have her own opinion. As a teacher of the Catholic faith, she is proclaiming the Catholic faith, not her opinions, all right? Not her opinions. And she is teaching inauthentically. This is truth in advertising. This is truth in labeling, all right? If I am teaching, if I am proclaiming, if I'm announcing to you, I'm going to teach a class in which I'm going to teach you the Catholic faith. But I only teach you those parts of the Catholic faith that I kind of like, and the parts that I'm uncomfortable with, I stray away from. And I, in fact, even teach you things that are absolutely contrary to what the Catholic Church teaches because I believe that the Church is wrong. Can I claim to be teaching you the authentic Catholic faith? And can I claim to be teaching in the name of the Church? No. And she was challenged on this, that you are teaching what is false, and she post-baptismally, obstinately refused to change that. All right? That's heresy. All right? Now, that does not necessarily lead to excommunication. She has not been excommunicated. All right? She has not been kicked out of her religious order. But what has been said is you cannot teach in our Catholic schools. You cannot teach in the name of the Church. You do not represent the Church when you teach. All right? If you teach, you're teaching as so-and-so. All right? Not as a representative of the Catholic Church. That's what happened there. All right? Okay. That's the first of the three sins against faith in God. The second is called apostasy, which is a total repudiation of the faith. This is saying, I don't believe any of this stuff, and I'm believing. All right? Let's say that I'm a Catholic, and I leave the Catholic Church, and I join another church. That is apostasy. All right? I have repudiated the Catholic faith, and I have gone to another church. Or I may repudiate Christianity altogether. All right? I may say, you know, I no longer am a Christian. I recently had a family who had at one time been registered here. I don't know that they're ever really actively practicing, but they were registered here, who contacted us and said, please take us off of your rolls because we no longer consider ourselves Christian. So I called and talked to them about that, and it was a very pleasant conversation. There was no hostility. There was no acrimony that was in there, but this couple had just come to decide that they no longer believed in Jesus, and they really didn't have a belief in any particular religion, but they just simply did not believe the essentials of what we believe, which is about Jesus. So they did no longer consider themselves Christian. That is apostasy. Historically, there have been those who have apostatized not even necessarily because they became convinced that the church was wrong, but perhaps it was in times of persecution, all right, and difficulty that they apostatized and they rejected the church. Now, if we apostatize, what do? We go to confession to come back, all right? And so it's, again, if I have joined another church, now if I was baptized and fully initiated as a Catholic, and I later joined another church, and now I want to come back to the Catholic Church, that's simply as easy as going to confession, all right, and getting back in right relationship with the church. The third is schism, and this involves a split, all right, and it refers to a split that is based on a rejection of the papacy, all right, and the schism, we use the term schism, not when we're talking about Protestantism, that's what the church calls heresy, all right, that there was a rejection of the truths of the Catholic faith. But what the Orthodox churches rejected was that we recognize that their theology is, as they call it, Orthodox. All right? They are not heretics, but they reject submission to the Pope. All right? So the split is called a schism. This, and it's kind of technical language, but that's just to help us understand that. So faith in God is required by this first commandment, and there are these three sins, heresy, apostasy, and schism, which are sins against faith in God. Secondly, hope. We talked about this last week, that Christian hope is not the same thing as the way our society tends to understand hope, which is wishful thinking. I hope I'm going to lottery. I hope I'm going to get this job. I hope the Bengals are going to win. Wow, there's some real hope. All right. All right, that's not the virtue of Christian hope. The virtue of Christian hope is a certain confidence. I am confident in a certain way. I am certain that something is going to come to me because it has been promised to me by God. All right? God has not promised me this particular job. God has not promised me the lottery. He has not promised me a lot of other things in my life that I may wish for, that I may want to have happen. They may be wonderful things, all right? But they are not promised to me, and so that wishful thinking is not what is meant by Christian hope. Christian hope is, I trust in the promises that have been made to me by God and by Christ, all right? And I stake my life on those promises. God has promised me that if I follow His Son Jesus, then He will show me the way to heaven. And that is my hope. I have absolute certitude that if I faithfully follow Christ, God will bring me to heaven. All right? That's what Christian hope is about.